Okay. So we are on the record, as they say in court. Anything I say may now be held against me. All right. So on evenings like this, when I'm going to be sharing some teachings from Buddha Dharma, I normally do my sitting practice pretty early in the morning. I get up and have a little tea and then go and just settle in and have a look at what the mind's up to. And on days when I'm going to teach, you know, whether our group or a different venue or setting, the mind kind of naturally goes to, what maybe am I going to talk about? What am I going to focus on? And oftentimes, if there's some event or phenomenon occurring in our community or society, I'll see if I can come up with a Dharma teaching that may have some relevance to that. But, you know, as a combat veteran with, you know, our withdrawal from this interminable military conflict in Afghanistan and commemorations of the 20th anniversary of 9/11, I realized that I was kind of 9/11'd out. I didn't really much want to go there, you know, with us this evening. And what happened instead when I was sitting this morning, just mindfully watching, viewing, being with what the mind was up to, I realized that I didn't really much care for what I was seeing. The mind was like, you know, like a monkey mind on acid, you know, it's kind of bouncing all over the rooms in my mind and just really refusing to settle down and flying off into this thought or this memory or that memory or this conjecture or that conjecture. Just a lot of kind of what felt like sort of chaotic energy. When that happens, I really kind of zero in on something like the four elements practice of paying attention to what the body literally feels like sitting on the cushion, what it feels like for the air to move in and out of the body, what the sensation of moisture in the mouth, the sensation of the pulse, you know, the fire alarm. Just do what I can to bring the attention back to being grounded in the body. And so that's mostly how I spent my time this morning. Except that there was also this little voice, you know, a sort of commentator, you know, like on Sunday morning talk shows. There was this kind of running background commentary saying, good God, you know, you've been doing this stuff for over 40 years. You know, can't you just calm down and find a little peace and maybe even a little joy? And that did not really seem to be the case this morning. So at some point, you know, I usually sit for about 45 minutes or so. And at some point, I just sort of gave up and said enough already, you know. And I sent the blessing phrases from the Bardo Todol to our friend who's dying. And then just sort of gave up, you know, and went upstairs and got something to eat. With this residual sense of my not having had a good sit this morning, right? And so, and no clue whatsoever as to what we might talk about this evening. And then I went outside. over the course of this summer, been spending a lot of time working on the landscaping around our home, you know, putting up trellises and planting climbing vines and building raised beds for growing this and that, putting in bird baths to go along with our feeder and a fountain and such. And so I just went outside to do that. And when I went outside, suddenly I was just struck. It was something happened. It was like there was this sort of click or this little moment where I just said, you know, this feels different. Something's different here. And so I noticed that the sky was clear and blue, and that the air felt soft. It was warm and breezy, but not hot. That the air was clean and healthy. And I realized that it was dramatically different from how I've been experiencing most of this summer. And I don't think that I would have been well tuned in to this difference that I felt and still feel. You know, it was like suddenly when I went outside and all thoughts vanished, and I just felt somehow completely in sync with the environment. It was like there was no difference between me and it. It was just kind of absorbed in this energy that was going on. And partly was the realization, I don't know why, that today was that different from yesterday or whatever, that the changing of the seasons is underway. And I just felt it in kind of in my bones, kind of, right? You know, it's just like I felt both in tune with the environment, and the environment also felt different than it had been. So those of you who've known me for a while, and especially who have been sitting with me for a while, you know that, you know, in the 30 plus years that I've been here in Denver, every fall going into winter, I start yammering about the weather, right? But I was born in Los Angeles and raised in the Sonoran Desert, and I can stand any amount of heat, but I really, really, you know, have a hard time dealing with the dead of winter and the moving into that season. And one of the things that dawned on me that I realized is that mindset was absent, not present at all. That in the past, in the summer times, you know, I would look forward to the spring and the summer, and I would embrace it, and it was my favorite time of year, and I was really, you know, attached to it, attached to how the mind body felt during that time of year, and extremely aversive to the late fall and the winter. And then all of a sudden, what I noticed today is, wow, you know, my personal experience is that most of this summer has been a hell realm. You know, hottest summer on record. Air was foul and dangerously polluted. And I felt, I didn't feel safe to go out and ride my bike or exercise out of doors or do, you know, much of anything for a great deal of the summer. And I realized I had become aversive to summer, you know, this season that I used to wholeheartedly embrace, and that I was actually looking forward to fall, looking forward to it getting cooler and calming down and settling, you know, and that season when we start to draw inward a little bit and look inward a little bit more. And it was interesting. It was insightful. It's humbling, you know, the how the likes and the dislikes can shift. So, like, there's not a plethora of majestic teachings I'm trying to convey tonight. But what happened today, and maybe I'll just kind of deal with a little bit of kind of stream of conscious imagery here, is that with this realization, kind of just being in tune with things as they are, some of the teachings, mostly from the Vajrayana tradition, actually the Tibetan Buddhist tradition that I practiced in for a while, really kind of seem to fall into place or present themselves. And one of the teachings, it's kind of a Tibetan elaboration of the, you know, the Brahmanic kind of cycle of life or circle of life, wheel of samsara. The teaching of the Bardos. Bardo means time and place of transition. Right? And in the Buddha's, in the Tibetan teachings on the Bardos, there are kind of advanced teachings that are quite elaborate. Now, there are many of these times of transition, and they can be associated with different states of mind and deep meditation and whatnot. I tend to adhere more to this kind of simpler model that emphasizes, and this is in Sogyal Rinpoche's Tibetan Book of Loving and Dying. It's kind of his grand treatise on the Bardo Total, Tibetan Book of Great Liberation on Hearing the Bardo. That we live in a continuous state of transition. All is change, everything is always in flux. And that there are four great Bardos, or time and place of transition, that are really worth contemplating, focusing on, reflecting on the meaning of. One is the Bardo of being, the one that we're in now. Okay. We tend to think of this as a static and permanent state, not as a state of transition, because the apparent rate of change is not fast. Okay. Things seem to just sort of change very slowly and very incrementally, whether it's, you know, the aging of our bodies or, you know, just life in general. And this life, this being here, Bardo of being, okay, we tend to think of it more of just a static state than we do a time of transition, except that, in fact, change is happening continuously from the time we're born, grow up, develop, age. Near the end of the Bardo of being, transition occurs into the Bardo of dying, the period that, in our view, happens much more quickly, more quickly than perhaps we'd like it to. And this is the time when the body is beginning to disaggregate, you know. Like Sakya ruler of the Devas said, as the Buddha was dying, or just after he died, you know, these famous phrases that are repeated in all memorial services in Theravada Buddhism, all compounded things are impermanent. They arise and they pass away, for that is their nature. Okay. Those who understand this truth attain the highest joy, or realize the highest joy. So, Bardo of dying, after which comes the Bardo of non-being, of non-corporeal existence, either absolute nothingness or non-corporeal existence in, you know, what in the Theravada is called the Deva realms, for instance. Okay. And then the fourth bardo in this cycle is the bardo of becoming. And that happens with rebirth. So one classical way of thinking about this is that this is the cycle of the process of consciousness that a human being goes through. Bardo of being, bardo of dying, bardo of non-being, bardo of becoming, of rebirth. The way Sogyal Rinpoche teaches it as well, that it's something that's going on continuously in our minds. That being, dying, non-being, rebirthing is something that the mind is doing on an ongoing basis as it repeatedly conjures the self. And so to the extent that we're able to understand or to see that that's the process of consciousness moment to moment, then that also makes it easier when the time of death comes for us to realize that, again, it's just another phase or transition state in this ongoing cycle. The reason that I am kind of walking us through this, I think a lot of you probably already know this stuff or heard me teach it before, is that for me, there is likewise a really interesting parallel with the cycle of the seasons, right? Especially in the Northern Hemisphere. You know, but also in Central and South America, most of the great civilizations, you know, they had cities and superstructure and whatnot. I had some kind of observational structure that they built to help them stay in sync with or in line with or attuned to or knowledgeable of what was going on with the cycle of the seasons, the solar cycles, okay. So whether it's the pyramids in Central and South America, Stonehenge in England, the prayer circles among the plains tribes of Northern North America, they all have this means of laying out on the land somehow or another sort of a map or a link or a means of being in touch with and sync with what's going on in the environment around us with the cycle of the seasons, okay. So in this way, you know, the bardo of being, you know, is early spring and life comes forth and summer and blossoms and blooms and green leaves and the surge of life, you know, flowing throughout the environment. And then along comes fall. There's the gathering in and all the leaves on the trees die. Fall down, and there is this gathering in, you know, the time of darkness, of coldness, of constriction, you know. And then, so we go into that phase, and then into the winter, right? The time of hibernation, the time of slowed life functions, the time of deep sleep, the time of unawareness, you know, less and less time spent out of the doors encountering the environment and the light of day and more time inside, you know, perhaps in a very deep internal state of consciousness that's basically unconnected to that which is around us, okay. And then of course, at the end of that period, once again, comes the bardo of becoming. You emerge from winter into spring. And so this grand cycle, you know, that the human life is thought to trace, also in many, in the understanding, certainly of a lot of indigenous peoples, but also historical civilizations, that the same thing happens with regard to the seasons and the life rhythms of entire cultures at the same time. So for me, like this morning, it was helpful to realize, aha, you know, I'm not separate from, I'm not different from this shift that's happening now, you know, gradually leaving Bardo of being, moving toward the Bardo of dying and non-being, you know, that's just part of this grand circle that we're all a part of, whether we want to be or not. When the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, before he became the Buddha, was being groomed to take over the kingdom. His father was the monarchical leader of this kind of minor fiefdom, this kingdom in northeastern India. Part of the training of people in his station actually was to raise them to adulthood, carefully shielding them from all unpleasantry, you know, from all knowledge of that which is difficult to bear, make sure that they lived a life that was essentially free of suffering. And then around the time they're expected to take over the reins of leadership, they're suddenly exposed to how the other 99% lives. And so there's the story of the Buddha going forth, the Siddhartha Gautama going forth with one of the palace employees to go out and get provisions. And he's deliberately taken to places where he can see people living in poverty and serious want. He can see people aging without any of the efforts to fend off aging the way that he had in his palace. He can see people who are infirm and injured and suffering in that way. And he saw people who were dying. So he was really exposed to, suddenly, to all these forms of human suffering. And the idea was to, then he comes back to the palace, and then the monarch, his father, says, well, you know, now you see how the rest of the world lives. If you want to continue living like you are now, shielded and well fed and all your needs being met, then you need to agree to take over the administration of this government to maintain the status quo, to keep things how they are. If you choose not to do that, then you have to go forth and be one of them. You know? And so the Buddha was so shaken by all of the suffering he saw in the world that he didn't feel like he could turn his back on it. And so he went forth, you know, and spent 6 years as a mendicant monk. What he was doing when he went forth was he was trying to investigate why it is that these states of life that seem difficult to bear caused so much suffering. Because they're actually quite natural. In this cycle of life, you know, one ages, good old wagon, but it done broke down, right? You know, he should have read the fine print before he took delivery on these things, you know? Different parts have different warranties, you know, they wear out at different times, a bummer, you know? And so none of us ever knows what's going to go first, and we've tried to advance the science to let us swap out our parts, you know, or recondition them and put them back in again. But at some point, you know, there's no more to do about it. Like our friend who's going out on leukemia, we've got another friend who's going out on ALS, we've got Sangha members go out on brain cancer. You know, it's the nature of human existence. So the Buddha wanted to find out why it was that there is so much resistance in the human mind to this very natural process. So dukkha means resistance. It's kind of like grit in the mill, you know, or in the hub, literally, of the wheel. And you wanted to know, if you look at things from the standpoint of the Bardos, okay, it's this little segment from the Bardo of being to into the Bardo of dying that humankind seems to have such trouble with. And so he spent, you know, the rest of his life, or the next 6 years, looking into that. Why do we fear aging? Why do we fear infirmity? Why do we fear death? You know, why do we do everything we can to deny that these forces are at work, and what can be done about them? So attending to that particular segment of the cycle, you know, eventually brought him to the understanding that so much fear and angst and suffering is caused because of our disinclination or refusal to acknowledge that we are of the earth, that we are in fact part of all that is, and that being that, we are just as subject to these laws of the cyclic energy of nature as anything else. You know, letting go of the notion that we are different or special or separate, he said, is the key to the cessation of suffering. And the core of the source of suffering, he taught, was this this enduring belief in a permanent and separate and abiding self. And it was that, it's that function of mind that keeps us separate from nature, and it's that function of mind that needs to be investigated and at some point let go of in order for suffering to cease. True for the human being, the individual, true for communities, true for society as a whole. Another teaching from the Vajrayana is the teaching of the three kayas, or the three bodies. And in this teaching, there are three realms of existence that we each individually experience and that we collectively share. The first is the first body, kaya, is the nirmana kaya. And the Tibetans call this the fear body. It's the physical body that we inhabit, right? But that also provides the Dharma seat for our consciousness. And we attain freedom and attain awakening in this body, in this mind-body process. The second body, Sambhogakaya, that is taught in this understanding, is what they call the rainbow body or energetic body or aura. And it is a Chinese and Taoist philosophy, qi, right? And so it's this aura of energy that resides in the body, but that also emanates from and is external to the nirmanakaya as well. So for instance, in all these stories that we hear about people who are involved in horrible traffic accidents or something, and they're about to die and they're on the operating table in the ER, and all of a sudden, you know, they're put under anesthesia. And so we have all these stories of people who feel their consciousness leave their body, and inevitably, and for people I've been around who are dying, they all see the same thing. It's the point where the wall meets the ceiling. And there is a kind of an emanation or an entity there. It's also for people who understand the devas, and for whom they're a real part of their lives. That's usually where you see the devas. It's really kind of embarrassing for a lot of people in the ER, because after they wake up and the surgery's over, they speak with great specificity about what different members of the ER surgical team said and did while they were working on it, right? Much to the consternation of the ER team, because, you know, they tend to refer to burn victims as crispy critters and shit like that. You know, it's a way of trying to emotionally distance themselves from whoever it is they're working on. But we got a lot of evidence that the consciousness actually can leave the body and but remain within this aura and then look back on things that are going on. The third body is called the Dharmakaya, the body of truth, the body of the Dharma. And this is the great cosmic entity of which we're all a part. Language in the Mahayana, it is the formless form entered through the gateless gate. And the poem by Kalu Rinpoche, it says, you live in appearance and you live in illusion and the appearance of things. He's saying, you normally reside in the Dharmakaya, and see things from that perspective. Since there is a reality, you are that reality, but you do not know it. When you realize this is so, you will see that you are nothing, and that being nothing, you are everything. That is all. So what he's doing is describing the Dharmakaya. He said, right, you think you're somebody, something in this body, but you're not. And when you realize that's the case, you'll let go, the consciousness lets go of being in this body, in the Dharmakaya, and emanates forth into the cosmos, and the cosmos is like alternating energy. Now you see it, now you don't, now you see it, now you don't. It's the world of being and of non-being of which we're all a part. And so, for instance, when I was talking about this experience, and I think, most of us have had something like this happen to us, where there's the sense of not being a self anymore, but just being part of this great pulsating earth, that's all around us, not being separate from. Okay, that's the Dharmakaya. So here we are in this grand cycle, going through life individually, going through life culturally, going through life, cosmically. I'm framing things in this way because looking back on this summer, it seemed, it felt to me like we were really living in a kind of a hell realm. I had a really interesting conversation with my next door neighbor not long ago. And he said, we were just talking about the weather and how crappy the air was and whatnot. Said, well, here we are living through the hottest summer on record, just like we did 2 years ago. Only this one's even hotter. And he said, it may also well be the coolest summer that we experience for the rest of our lives. So I found myself, it was shocking and sobering, and I could hear the truth of what he was saying, right? In this day when the air is clear and the sky is blue and the temperatures are moderate, the mind desperately wants to think, wow, this summer really sucked, right? Well, had to be kind of an anomaly. It certainly won't be like that again next summer. All the climate modelers say that's not true. Say that what we just lived through is nothing more than a preview of things to come. For years, in talking about global heating and climate change, we've been saying, wow, things are really looking bad for the next generation. Wow, sometime down the road, it's going to be really crummy and horrible, right? Well, sometime is now. Most recent IPCC report says exactly that. There's all these events that were projected to occur sometime in the next decade or two are happening much more quickly and much more severely than was modeled. It is upon us. Okay. And so and the reason I've laid out these different frameworks or ways of thinking about things is that in some ways it feels like we as a culture and the environment we live in is entering the bardo of dying. It is a time of death. You know, hundreds of millions of trees and hundreds of thousands of wildlife have perished this summer in the mega fires of the Mountain West. It's still going on. A few days down the road, the wind's going to shift again. The biggest fires in California are only about half contained. And we're going to experience that some more. Next summer, it's going to be the same thing. The sight and the smell and the taste of the air that we experienced this summer is the sight and the smell and the taste of death. Yeah. The environment, great swaths of it, is literally dying as we're here. And that needs to be understood. It needs to be acknowledged, you know. We have created a situation that is drawing us into this bardo. And so for millions of acres of forest lands, California, here in Colorado for that matter, those lands are dead now. The lands where the mega fires occurred, when you have ground temperatures at around 1500 degrees, that kills everything deep into the soil, and it's going to be decades before anything, any life form can really take root there again. Right. Just like it's hard to come to terms with the death of a loved one or an individual, it's hard to come to terms with the fact that there is so much death and destruction being brought on by climate change, even as we live here. It's difficult to accept, it's difficult to acknowledge, but it seems necessary to do so. It seems necessary to do so because the cycle of life requires us to acknowledge what's being left at the same time we prepare for bringing new life into being. New life can only be brought into being if we live our lives differently going forward than we have in the past. When in the teachings in the Vajrayana, what the phrases in the Bardo Todol great book, it talks about what's going to happen during the dying process. And the Vajrayana understanding, one of the teaching objects that they use that they have on their altar is a crystal. And especially in the Dzogchen teachings, the Dzogchen master holds the crystal up and says, this is our consciousness. Right? Our consciousness is struck by the primordial light of the universe from which we came and to which we will return. When the primordial light strikes our consciousness, like a prism refracting light, we...
move forward into... the process of projecting that light onto the environment around us like a movie screen. And so the life that we live and the way we see our environment as nothing more than the projection of our own consciousness on the world. We literally produce our own movie and live in it and act in it and live it during the time we're alive. The energy of our consciousness projects this vision outward. At the moment of dying, what happens is that all the energy that had gone into projecting our consciousness around us is no longer there. And as a result, all of the projections that we put on the environment return and they come back to us and we see them. And at the moment of death, all of that, all of our projected consciousness returns to us. And so the phrases in the book say, during this process, during this time of change, you will see many visions, some of them beatific, some of them horrific. Do not become attached to the beatific ones. Do not be frightened of the horrific ones, for they are nothing more than emanations of your own consciousness. So in other words, it's saying what you experience at the time of death is your own karma. All your words and deeds, your actions that you pasted onto the walls of your being, your state of being, you know, are going to come back at you. You will experience the consequences of your karma in your consciousness at the time of death. I think it's possible to understand that what's happening for us right now, whether it's got to do with some of the dramatic events that we're experiencing in our environment, whether it's wildfires or floods, is a result. It's the karmic consequences of actions that we in society have taken in the past. Okay. The social strife that's occurring right now, you know, those who would prefer to live in a white supremacist autocracy instead of a multicultural democracy, that the social rivening that's happening there is likewise a product of our national karma, or colonial karma, you might say, right? So all we are doing in the realm of social action and social life, our culture, our environment, all we are doing now is experiencing the consequences of the past actions of our culture. And according to the laws of karma, whether the suffering is bound to get worse or whether we can alleviate the suffering is based upon the state of consciousness and our words and deeds going forward. So from the Buddha Dharma context, the suffering that we may find ourselves now experiencing, you know, perhaps to some extent, you know, it might be thought of as going through the bardo of dying insofar as vast swaths of our environment is concerned, okay? We are simply doing nothing more but experiencing the karmic consequences of our past actions as a society, okay? Whether we replicate and continue to prolong that suffering or whether we can see clearly enough into its causes to do something about it is up to us. You know, so it's like the Dharma is no less applicable to the challenges that we face with insofar as our relationship to our earth, insofar as our relationship to each other. Okay. No less applicable to that suffering than it is to our own individual circumstances. So that was my kind of stream of consciousness today. As I've been thinking about, you know, what we're up against as a society, what we're, you know, what we're up against insofar as our relationship with our earth. So please, I just love to, you know, been yammering away for a while now. I'd like to just talk about these matters, you know. If you have any thoughts or questions or anything you'd like to share, this is the time, please. Deb.
Well, it struck me that possibly a majority of us are in our 70s. So there's the cosmic cycle, there's the cycle of the seasons, and there's the cycle of our lives.
Yes.
A lot of us are getting ready to die. That's all.
Quite so, you know, my wife and daughters have been running around Metro Denver looking at retirement communities. They keep asking me to come along on one of their outings. And so far I've been extremely resistant to do so, you know. I have my woodworking projects and I have my landscaping projects, and the idea of not being able to continue doing those things, I find to be quite offensive. And at the same time, I realize that part of my resistance is just, you know, wanting to ignore this, you know. She says, yeah, but you know, we've got friends dying left and right. And she says, one or the other of us might suddenly get really sick, and not when we won't be able to care for each other, you know. We hope that won't happen, or won't happen soon, but it's not to ignore that possibility and not think about it. It's, you know, it's not in keeping with the Dharma, basically. You're right. So that's one of the reasons that I find the Dharma comforting. It's like the model of human life that we inherited as a culture that we were born into is kind of this once through thing, right? Very linear, beginning, middle, end. I find myself, and I'm not a great believer, and I don't believe at all in literal reincarnation, but the idea of a continuous cycling of the process of consciousness. You know, that while we're here this time around, we do what we can, and that the karma we create for ourselves every day of our lives now going forward, okay, is cumulative. And as we pass on, as we disincorporate, okay, that merit, those activities, carry forward just like dropping a rock in a pond. Yeah. We don't know what the effect of our actions are going to be. We don't know what the effect of those actions might be on our own process of consciousness if you keep the mind open to the possibility that rebirth is real, that rebirth happens, okay? So one way to think about it, and the Buddha says this, didn't say this is how it is. He said, abide contemplating the possibility that this is so, which is that the quality of our lives, the actions we take and the intention underlying them now is like a force, like a wave in the ocean. Okay. And it moves through the bardo of dying. It moves through the bardo of not a non-being. It moves through the bardo of becoming. And so this positive force, you know, we don't know what form it's going to take upon our demise. We don't know whether if indeed our process of consciousness reemerges in another entity, whether there'll be any recollection of what we did this time around. But in the Buddhist understanding, the merit of the actions that we take now will be visited upon those who follow. Thank you. Please, others, anybody? Ken?
I think that, I'll be interested in your understanding, Lloyd, of the fact that we're also dealing with a collective karma, that we're dealing with the collective actions that we in the past have taken, but that many, many other people have taken and in the generations past have taken. So that we're now seeing the more difficult to countenance results, but we're also having to look at the fact that it's not only our actions, but those of many, many other people.
Absolutely. And there's really, yeah, you're right. We are experiencing the consequences of each other's behaviors. You know, bummer. it's absolutely inescapable, right? And that one is a hard one for me to accept. You know, when I see and hear people doing things that I think are just profoundly unskillful, like those who are not only, for instance, refusing to get vaccinated, but attacking and harassing people who are trying to vaccinate others, things like that, you know, that seem to be actively working against the common good. Those are the people that I have real difficulty not feeling aversion toward, you know, because like it or not, you know, we're all affected by what they do. At the end of the day, however, we only ultimately have control over our responsibility for what we do. What Buddha Dharma, I think, brings to the dialogue, is that it provides us a little bit of insight into the fear that's gripping those who behave in that way. They're coming from a place of suffering. You know, their consciousness is hanging out in a hell realm, basically. And so anything that can be done to assuage their fear is a good thing. And beyond that, you know, we simply have to live with those effects. Deb, you had something to, you were going to add?
Well, I was going to add that you talked about and just talked about the karma of society. And I always kind of thought it was the karma of our species. Because given the fact that we had opposable thumbs to make tools with and big brains to make tools with, and we could walk on two legs, so we could use those opposable thumbs and other things. I just think the handwriting must have been on the wall from the get-go. And so if that's karma species-wide, then that's how I've always kind of seen it.
Yeah. Ethologists like Conrad Lawrence, you know, in his book on aggression, the way he characterizes it is that our consciousness is, as a species, is kind of in a horse race with itself. You know, that, and the way he characterizes it is the tension or the competition between knowledge, wisdom, and power, which is to say, like Deb was saying, we have a capacity for amassing tremendous knowledge of how the world works, okay, in terms of science and technology. and tools for the saving of life and the enhancement of life, and tools for the destruction of life and the rendering of enormous suffering on all sentient beings. We have that power. We have the knowledge of how to use the power. That's in competition with the growth of wisdom, so that the power and the knowledge can be used in ways that are not self-destructive. And that's an ongoing evolutionary process. When I was writing my book on worship in the wilderness, in the first or second chapter, I think it was, I talk about attending the deer dance at the Taos Pueblo in 1999. And in the deer dance, all these dancers come out of the kiva and they're all wearing the skins of wild animals, and they're pantomiming or dancing or playing the role of wise animal, of wild animals in nature, in the wilderness. And then there are some dancers who are in a white face, and they're playing the role of clowns. They're the clowns. They're playing the role of the hunters. And so they pantomime killing, they're in this enclosure, and they pantomime killing the wildlife. And, you know, and they sling them over their shoulder, and then they try to leave the valley. And at the mouth of the valley, and this is actually the way that the Taos Pueblo people hunt up in the mountains up around Kit Carson Peak. They go up around the rim of a canyon and start beating the bushes, and it scares all the wildlife to start running down into the mouth of the canyon. Hunters are there to start blowing them all away. The reason they do the deer dance is as the hunters try to leave the canyon with the animals they've killed, these two tall guys in white buckskin, and my host there for the deer dance said that the nearest English translation to the Tiwa word is like wardens, and they tell the hunters they have to release the wildlife and let them, give them new life, let them go back into the canyon again. And so my host, after the dance, when we were eating, he explained it to me, and he said, this is actually a dance they've been doing for about 700 years, ever since the Pueblo peoples had to migrate out of the Four Corners area and around Mesa Verde and whatnot, because they experienced environmental collapse. You know, there's prolonged drought, and their crops failed. They couldn't hunt enough, and so they had basically overstretched the resource base, and it crashed on them. Okay. So this is a teaching that they give to each other year after year after year. He said the teaching, the understanding, is that the hunters have lots of knowledge and lots of power. They know how to round up wildlife, corral them together, and kill them, you know, in great numbers, okay? What they lack is wisdom. They don't understand that if they use their knowledge and power that way, they're going to wipe out the resource base and there'll be nothing left and the tribe will starve. And so knowledge and power have to be tempered with wisdom in order for the tribe to survive. So what Conra Lawrence is saying, you know, kind of what Deb is referring to as well here a little bit, is saying, that's it. We're in this kind of evolutionary race with ourselves between knowledge and power on the one hand and wisdom on the other, you know, that we're desperately, it's a pretty good way of explaining what Buddha Dharma is all about too. It's like, it's trying to rev up or enhance our capacity for the cultivation of wisdom, so that we use our knowledge and power in ways that sustain the well-being of all sentient beings rather than destroying them. Okay. and which of these contending forces is going to win. You know, the final chapter hasn't been written. You know, all we know is that we are in this, you know, in this ongoing sort of struggle with ourselves, you know. What Uncle Abe called the better angels of our nature on the one hand, and then the forces of, you know, the Kalesis, greed, hate, and delusion on the other, you know. That is the dynamic that we find ourselves living in right now. Yeah. Interesting time to be around, isn't it?
End times.
Okay, my friends, we've come up onto the 8 o'clock hour. Thanks for coming around. Appreciate us being able to spend some time, you know, reflecting on these things in a way that I hope is useful. You know, we're in a pretty grim situation, but there's cause for hope, you know. And none of us knows for sure what the ultimate effect of any beneficial speech or action that we take might be. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it, right? Please stay safe and be well. Have a good week. Let's just take a moment, return to our sitting posture if we can, and allow the eyes to gently close. May we live with ease and know ease of well-being. May we be safe from all inner and outer harm. May we open to the joy that lies within us and be happy. May we find the silence and stillness within and be at peace with things as they are. May we find the strength and wisdom to speak and act for the benefit of all sentient beings. May we awaken and be free. Have a good week, everybody.
You too. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd.
Wonderful storytelling.
Stay safe and be well, everybody.